Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Now, you might have seen that Japan is releasing treated radioactive water from its tsunami-hit Fukushima nuclear power plant. But how did the 2011 disaster happen? And could it have been prevented?
It's all underwater.
Station blackout. Reactor control systems have lost all power.
Fukushima, a powerful podcast series from the BBC World Service, tells the story. Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 21st of August. Saudi Arabia is accused of the systematic killing of Ethiopian migrants at the border with Yemen.
I was shot between my thighs, near my groin, and my legs are paralyzed now. I can't even walk. At that moment, I thought I would die.
The Israeli army is searching for a suspected Palestinian gunman who shot dead an Israeli woman in the occupied West Bank. And the British serial killer nurse who murdered at least seven babies has been sentenced to life in prison. Also in the podcast, a return to the age of sail, the newly refurbished cargo ship using wind power. Every year, tens of thousands of people attempt the perilous journey from the Horn of Africa to Yemen and then Saudi Arabia. Many do not make it. According to Human Rights Watch, hundreds of them, many Ethiopians, have been gunned down by Saudi security forces on the border with Yemen. The Human Rights Organization has documented evidence which suggests that the killings have been systematic. Saudi Arabia has denied the claims first made by UN experts last October. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams has been hearing from migrants who tried to reach Saudi Arabia.
On the steep, rocky slopes of Yemen's northern mountains, migrants are on the move. Long lines of men and women, almost all of them Ethiopian, scrambling their way towards the nearby border with Saudi Arabia, escaping poverty and war at home in search of opportunity. But gunfire reverberates across the slopes and through the valleys. The journey ahead is fraught with danger.
We were shot and beaten at the Saudi border, and those who shot us were Saudi men. They wore Saudi Arabia's military uniform.
A man we're calling Ibsa describes a terrifying night at the border. He's still in Yemen, so he doesn't want us to use his real name.
They beat us, killed some, took those who survived to hospital. The bodies of those killed were left scattered on the ground. I was the only one who survived. They took me to a hospital where a bullet was taken out of my body. I was shot between my thighs, near my groin, and my legs are paralyzed now. I can't even walk. At that moment, I thought I would die.
For 2 years, stories like this have become almost routine. The world, perhaps a little bored by Yemen's endless tales of war and famine, has somehow not taken much notice. That might be about to change.
So at Human Rights Watch, what we documented are essentially mass killings.
Nadia Hardman is the lead author of the report published today.
Saudi border guards have fired explosive weapons and shot migrants and asylum seekers at close range on their international border with Yemen. The majority of people told me that their groups were women and children and described sites that sound like killing fields. And if there's a deliberate policy of murder, they would amount to a crime against humanity.
Describe to us what kinds of things you have seen in these videos you've been collecting.
The footage is horrifying. It really is. And mostly it's the guilt that people feel watching the people they've tried to cross with die in front of them and having to run away because they're running for their lives.
Survivors of these horrors show deep signs of trauma. In Sana'a, Yemen's capital, a young woman we're calling Zahra can barely bring herself to speak about what happened at the border. Her journey through Yemen, which had already cost almost £2,000 in ransoms and bribes to smugglers, ended in a hail of gunfire. One bullet took all the fingers of her right hand. Asked about the injury, she looks away and cannot answer. Some of those who don't make it across the border end up back where they started, in Ethiopia. Mustafa Sufia Mohammed is one of them, at home now, still getting used to walking with a prosthetic left leg. He shows us a video taken just after he arrived in hospital in July last year. His foot has been severed. He's in agony. He says he was hit by some kind of rocket.
We got shot at while we were walking. Immediately, we all lie down on the ground. I didn't even realize I was shot. But when I tried to get up and walk, part of my leg wasn't there. The shooting went on and on and on. I hid behind a rock to save my life. I know it's economic hardships that made me leave, but I do regret it. I always wonder why I made such a fate attempting to improve my life.
Ethiopian migrants are still dying on the Saudi border. In a cemetery in the northern Yemeni city of Saada, one was buried 2 weeks ago. Others with terrible injuries are being treated in local hospitals. Why these killings are taking place isn't clear. When allegations were first raised by the UN last year, the Saudi government denied that anything systematic was going on. It hasn't yet replied to us or to Human Rights Watch.
That report by Paul Adams. The West Bank is home to nearly 3 million Palestinians, but it's been occupied by Israel since the war of 1967. Nearly 500,000 Israelis now live there in settlements regarded as illegal under international law, but which are championed by some in Israel's hard-right government. Tensions, which have been around for years, have spiked in recent months with a cycle of killings involving Palestinians, Jewish settlers and the Israeli army. The latest happened today, as I heard from our correspondent in Jerusalem, Tom Bateman.
Well, this latest incident was a drive-by shooting on the main north-south highway in the occupied West Bank, Route 60. And it seems to have happened close to the city of Hebron. Well, it was close to the city of Hebron, but also close to several Israeli settlements that are outside the city. There's also Israeli settlements in the heart of Hebron, a very large Palestinian city as well. This car that was hit was being driven by a man who is badly wounded, and a 40-year-old woman was a passenger. She was killed. There was also a child in the car as well, and conflicting reports about the age, but that child unharmed from the gunfire. What we now know is that this was a vehicle that apparently was later found burned out. The Israeli military has now closed off the entrances and exits of Hebron, is searching Palestinians, and you know, clearly adding to the sense of tension there. And as you say, comes at a time of rising bloodshed in the occupied West Bank once again. So the third death of an Israeli in the last 2 days. And after these very violent scenes of deadly Israeli military raids over the past 18 months, rising Palestinian gun attacks, and also we've seen, you know, rising numbers of rampages by Israeli settlers targeting Palestinian homes in the West Bank too.
And does anyone have any idea of how to stop this cycle of violence?
Well, the fundamental problem is that there is no realistic political horizon, and there hasn't been for a very long time. And so, you know, just as a kind of signifier as to the sense of escalation, what we've seen after the recent killings of Israelis in the West Bank are settler social media groups, WhatsApp groups, Telegram groups calling for revenge. We've seen the far right calling for a far greater military response against Palestinians in the West Bank. And at the same time, Palestinian militant groups, for example, Hamas, saying that, you know, this is a result of Israel's occupation policies, and also linking it as to what it sees as threats to Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem itself. So at the moment, no sign of things abating.
Tom Bateman in Jerusalem. Her crime has shocked Britain. The nurse who murdered at least 7 babies in her care in hospital and tried to kill a further 6. Lucy Letby is the most prolific serial child killer in Britain in modern times. For her sentencing, she refused to leave her cell to appear in the dock at Manchester Crown Court. But the judge, Justice Goss, addressed her as though she was there.
You acted in a way that was completely contrary to the normal human instincts of nurturing and caring for babies, and in gross breach of the trust that all citizens place in those who work in the medical and caring professions. The babies you harmed were born prematurely, and some were at risk of not surviving. But in each case, you deliberately harmed them, intending to kill them.
Earlier, the families of her victims read out personal statements detailing the impact that her crimes had had on them. Then came the sentence.
Because the seriousness of your offences is exceptionally high, I direct that the early release provisions do not apply. The order of the court, therefore, is a whole life order on each and every offence, and you will spend the rest of your life in prison.
Our reporter Rowan Bridge spoke to Sarah Montague from Manchester Crown Court.
Well, there was silence in court and some of the parents were crying as Mr Justice Goss delivered his comments. I think what's interesting is he gave 13 whole life orders. So for each crime that Lucy Letby was convicted of, he handed her a whole life order. Each order means that she would spend the rest of her life in jail. But I think given he wanted to show the sheer seriousness with which he viewed these crimes, that she has been given whole life orders for each of the crimes that she committed, each murder and attempted murder. He told her that the offences were of very exceptional seriousness, that they were cruel, calculated and cynical campaign of murder, but also that there was, as he put it, a deep malevolence bordering on sadism to what she'd done, that she'd shown no remorse, that there were no mitigating factors. And then he turned and spoke to the families involved and talked about how their behaviour and dignity has been of the highest, which I sincerely acknowledge with gratitude, and also thank the jurors for their role in a case which they had to sit through 9 gruelling months of evidence and spent more than a month considering their verdicts before returning the guilty verdicts on Lucy Letby. Those 13 whole life orders mean she will only be the 4th woman in UK history to be told she'll never be released from prison. Others include people like Myra Hindley, Rose West and Joanna Dennehy.
Rowan, I mean, it was an extraordinary morning in court this morning because of the victim impact statements, which, what were, from the sounds of it, were what heard in silence by a very emotional court.
Yes, I mean, I think it was an incredibly difficult and incredibly emotional time for everybody who was there. So there were family members of the babies who were in court, but also 8 of the 11 jurors who sat through this trial, which has lasted more than 10 months, also came back to hear the family statements. And I think for those families, this really was the first time they've been able to personally talk about the impact of these events on them and their families, what it has meant to them to have their children murdered or for Lucy Letby to attempt to murder them. Some of them had spoken during the trial, but that was much more in a kind of factual evidence about what they saw and heard when Lucy Letby was around. But now they know for sure that their child was attacked by Lucy Letby and they've had to try and come to terms with that. And this was their chance to express exactly the impact that has had on them.
Rowan Bridge at Manchester Crown Court. Many people around the world are facing higher costs as governments raise interest rates to try to combat inflation. But China has the opposite problem, falling prices and the spectre of deflation. The world's second biggest economy is in trouble as its post-COVID recovery runs out of steam, the result of a property crisis, falling exports and weak spending. In response, the communist authorities in Beijing have now cut a key interest rate for the second time in 3 months. So is China in trouble here? I asked our correspondent in Beijing, Stephen McDonnell.
It's definitely in some very rough waters economically. I mean, people expected this country to bounce right back after zero COVID and all the restrictions we had here. But actually, it's been pretty sluggish. Youth unemployment hovering at around 20%, property bubble fears, household spending down, local government debt. I mean, it's all pretty gloomy. And so what the government's done is to change one of its interest rates, the one-year benchmark lending rate, by a small tinkering, but didn't touch another key rate, a five-year rate. And what this seems to show is that they're worried about, they want some stimulus, but they actually don't want to pump the property market up a whole lot because part of the problem has been the overblown property market. And so they're just sort of slowly trying to get things going again.
Yeah, I mean, the rest of the world had been pinning their hopes on China driving a global recovery after COVID. What does this lacklustre performance mean for everyone else?
Well, I think you've got a situation now, too, where China's kind of counting on the rest of the world, funnily enough. And what they're hoping is that next year, there'll be a bigger global demand for all the stuff that China makes. and that this will lead to more exports and also more imports in China. And because of the size of the Chinese economy, that will then feed into all these other economies and sort of drive everybody along. But at the moment, you know, we've got this problem with deflation here. It's partly because people are worried. There's just households aren't spending that much because they're just nervous about the future. Businesses aren't spending. And so they're making people's employment prospects more dodgy. And so then they're more nervous and spending even less. And around you go. It's going to take a while to turn around, I think.
Stephen McDonnell in Beijing. Red S, or relative energy deficiency, is a condition which affects athletes all over the world, but it's one that's rarely discussed. In fact, sports governing bodies have been accused of sweeping it under the carpet. It tends to happen when competitors fail to properly refuel after strenuous exercise, and it can result in lifelong pain and disability. It is more prevalent in endurance events, but also affects sports like gymnastics and climbing. Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick has this report from Hungary.
Commitment, determination, sacrifice. This August, welcome to stunning Budapest.
World Championships brings the cream of track and field together. But straining to become the best can come at a cost.
Bringing him home, the crowds rise, and Jake Smith, the rising star of British marathon running, has got the job done.
Until a few years ago, the British distance runner Jake Smith was riding the crest of a wave. He was a winner with a big future. Then it all went wrong.
September 2021, that's where it just got so bad. I was like 23 years old and I got down to 51 kilos, weighing myself every day. And I'd be happier if I was lighter. It was just nuts.
So what was happening? Were you just not eating very much?
I say I'd burn in 4,000 or 5,000 calories. I wouldn't eat any more than 2,000. Because I was improving and getting lighter, I thought my body was unstoppable. And then it just broke, like broke. And this whole last year, I've had two stress fractures. Every time I raced, I just kept getting ill. And they said, you carry us on at the age of 30, you'll be in a wheelchair.
Jake was eventually told he had Red S, relative energy deficiency in sport. It's when athletes burn more calories than they take in. It was correctly diagnosed by Pippa Wolven, another endurance runner who created a website to highlight the issue. She once suffered from Red S herself, although she didn't recognise the symptoms.
They were very subtle at first. Things are often what you would expect from being a sports person, like illness and injury and just the odd cough and cold that takes a while to go away. But I was also suffering from menstrual dysfunction. I had lost my periods, but I didn't know that because I was using the contraceptive pill. And it was only when I came off the pill and the periods never returned that I realised that might have been playing a part of the problem. And later down the line, I experienced a stress fracture in my foot. I was just so used to getting on with it and being a sports person and pushing through things.
Pippa Wolven's website has helped raise awareness, but she says it's not enough and the sports authorities need to take it on.
There is a long way to go. I think there's a lot of health issues in sport that need tackling, and just like the concussion crisis, this will take time to reach a mass audience, but it definitely needs to start with governing bodies, in my opinion.
But it is an issue that World Athletics, for one, says it's taking seriously. Here in Budapest at the World Championships, it's a busy time for Dr. Stefan Berman, the head of health and science for track and field's global governing body. He says they're trying to educate coaches and federations about Red S. But, as he explains, it's a difficult process.
Sometimes the athlete doesn't really know about his or her condition. And sometimes, even if they know, they are still performing pretty well.
So you're saying the danger is, or the risk is, that if an athlete is performing well, then coaches and federations don't want to get in the way of that?
Absolutely, yeah. There is a time gap before you start to have Red S and you start to experience, let's say, a stress fracture of the foot. It can take 6 months, for instance, sometimes more. And within this period of time, you can achieve very good results. So why would you remove this female or male athlete from the competition?
Red S affects a wide range of athletes. Sport Climbing has recently denied allegations that it's been effectively turning a blind eye to the condition. Professor Volker Schürrle, lead physician for the German climbing team, is worried that unless more is done, Red S will continue to put at risk the long-term health of athletes.
You see people out there who everybody thinks, well, doesn't look very healthy. Are you sure she is? But then nothing is done about it. And the main problem is What you see is a picture of a young skinny girl doing sports, where you think, okay, she's pretty skinny, that's it. But I see the long-term consequences, because with 40, these people sit in my office, they have two hip replacements, they have another fatigue fracture on their feet, they're mentally messed up, they can't get pregnant, and their life is destroyed.
It's a stark warning. Red S might be complex and often difficult to diagnose, but its impact can be devastating.
Alex Capstick at the World Athletics Championships in Budapest. Still to come on the Global News podcast, the latest from California, where Storm Hillary brought torrential downpours to areas normally suffering drought.
All that started within an hour or two, and then just kept piling up, up, and the water keeps coming further back up the street.
And the novel approach to saving water being trialled by farmers in Tanzania.
Now, you might have seen that Japan is releasing treated radioactive water from its tsunami-hit Fukushima nuclear power plant. But how did the 2011 disaster happen? And could it have been prevented?
It's all underwater.
Station blackout. Reactor control systems have lost all power.
Fukushima, a powerful podcast series from the BBC World Service, tells the story. Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In the last episode of the Global News podcast, we told you about Russia's attempt to land on the moon, which ended in disaster after the craft spun out of control and crashed into the lunar surface on Sunday. All eyes are now on India, whose robotic probe, Chandrayaan-3, is due to land in 2 days' time. Radio 4's Justin Webb spoke to Mahesh Anand, who's a professor of planetary science and exploration at the Open University.
The Indian mission is not exactly trying to go to the same place, but in the same region. And the reason why the future missions are targeting the southern polar region of the moon is because of the possibility of finding frozen water ice, which could be potentially a very useful resource for supporting future missions to the moon, especially those that will carry humans there.
So the Indian mission is particularly important now that the Russian one has obviously failed.
Absolutely. I mean, these two missions were just going to be the first two of several that are planned for the southern polar region of the moon in the next few years. In fact, if you look at the plans for various space agencies and various even commercial entities, there are probably more than 10 or 15 missions that are lined up to be launched in the next few years.
There'll be a lot of people who'd be very pleased to see anything disastrous happening with Russians and rockets at the moment, given what's happening in Ukraine. But when you look at it from the point of view of the scientific community, I don't know whether you know any of the Russian scientists involved. I mean, is there a kind of still a fellow feeling, or has that fallen away?
As scientists, we are extremely sad to hear the unsuccessful nature of this mission, because whatever is happening here on Earth, there is still quite a lot of cooperation in space exploration. And we know that we are still collaborating with our Russian colleagues for getting astronauts to the International Space Station. So nobody that I know is actually happy to hear this news. We were all looking forward to learning more about the lunar southern polar region, because we know hardly anything about the nature of the material makeup of that place, and a place where one day, you know, humans might be actually operating and staying there for some considerable periods of time.
Professor Mahesh Anand talking to Justin Webb. The shipping industry is one of the world's biggest carbon emitters, but a newly refurbished cargo vessel has just set out on a voyage from China to Brazil, which could herald a return to wind power, at least in part. The five-year-old Pyxis Ocean has been retrofitted with large wing-like sails, which aim to reduce the use of its engine. The sails were designed by the British company BAR Technologies. John Cooper is the chief executive.
I do predict as soon as 2025, half the new builds will be ordered with wind propulsion. The reason I'm so confident of that are savings: 1.5 tons of fuel per day. So you get four wings on a vessel, that's 6 tons of fuel saved. That's 20 tons of CO2 saved per day. The numbers are massive.
I heard more about the design from our technology reporter, Tom Singleton.
These are sales, but not perhaps in the sense that you or I or our listeners would necessarily picture them, not the sails that have blown vessels across the sea for millennia. These are, in fact, wind wings. So think about the wing of a large passenger jet, that sort of size, about 40 metres. And then in terms of construction, they're made of a similar material to wind turbine blades. That's to make sure they're robust and can stand up to the kind of high winds that you'll get out on the open sea. The way they work is that they fold down when the ship is in port so they don't interfere with the cargo being loaded and unloaded. Then once the ship is at sail, in this case, as you mentioned, from China where these wings are fitted to Brazil, the ship's ultimate destination, they're folded out. They catch the wind just like sails have done since time immemorial and help, as you say, to push the ship across the sea. And the idea here is to save fuel. Exactly how much will depend on the wind conditions. And also, I think it will depend on how this technology actually performs at sea. But as you heard there from John Cooper, the boss of the UK company that has developed these wings, they have very high hopes for their technology.
Yeah, I mean, it could, if it works, make a big difference in reducing the amount of CO2 emitted by the shipping industry.
Yes, that's certainly the hope. So shipping is responsible for something like 2 to 3% of global CO2 emissions. That's equivalent to, roughly speaking, something like the outputs of Germany or Japan. So not an insignificant amount. So what we have within the shipping industry is a recognition that things need to change, but perhaps no clear idea exactly on how to do it. But have a listen to Jan Dieleman. He's the president of Cargill Oceans Transportation Division. That's the company responsible for retrofitting their ship. Listen to how he describes how attitudes are changing within shipping.
The narrative has changed completely and everybody is really convinced that they need to do their part. And I sincerely see that from a lot of angles. I think everybody here at the moment is a little bit struggling on how we're going to do this. And that's why we've taken the role and one of the larger players to just also underwrite some of the risk and trying out new things and really trying to move this industry forward.
Jan Dieleman from Cargill there. And Tom, are we really returning to an age of sail, but this time for these giant cargo ships?
Well, yes, potentially. I mean, if you speak to shipping experts, they're clear that wind power is promising. But we also do need a little bit of perspective here. There's something like 110,000 ships of one sort or another out there, and fewer than 100 at the moment have any kind of wind-assisted technology. And people are also very clear that it's not going to work for every single ship. If you think about a container ship, for example, loaded high with containers, you couldn't fit these kind of wind wings onto them. So what people tell me is that in terms of decarbonising the shipping industry, there's lots of things that are going to be needed. We're going to need better ship design. We're going to crucially need biofuels that don't contribute towards climate change. But as one of the experts put it to me, this is such an important issue and wind is potentially a useful contributor to decarbonising the shipping fleet that really we have to throw everything at it is how they described it. And I think that's what we're starting to see here.
Our technology reporter, Tom Singleton. The US state of California is normally more concerned about drought and wildfires rather than heavy rain. But on Sunday night, it was hit by its worst tropical storm in decades. Storm Hillary dumped record rainfall on Los Angeles and even desert areas like Palm Springs and Death Valley. It has since been downgraded to a tropical depression, but there are reports of widespread damage and overwhelmed drainage systems. Juan Feifar was one of the residents whose homes were threatened.
If this road floods, there is no way in or out. All that started within an hour or two, and then just kept piling up, up, and the water keeps coming further back up the street, and just more and more. It sucks to see it go, but lives can't be replaced, material objects can. And it's better just replace a house, fix whatever gets damaged, than risking somebody drowning over something that's avoidable.
Matthew Capucci is an atmospheric scientist and storm chaser from Palm Springs.
Some folks are seeing close to a year's worth of rain in just like 24 to 36 hours. In Death Valley, California, for example, they average about 4.78 centimeters worth of rain per year. They've never seen more than about 5 or 6 centimeters in a given year, and yet they were forecast between 5 and 10 centimeters worth of rain when all was said and done. And keep in mind, this is a desert landscape out here. There's a reason it's so dry. August is a dry season anyway, and so the sandy soils can't take in any of the moisture. So when you have a sudden 3, 4, 5 centimeters worth of rain, it accumulates with no place to go, causing devastating flooding. A number of roads are impassable, and ultimately there have been water rescues. There have been people who, at least in Mexico, lost their lives or waiting to hear reports in parts of California. Los Angeles Texas suffered significant flooding as well. So a lot of major metro areas, especially with all that pavement, have been unable to see that water drain. Right now, things are winding down in Southern California, but Central California and the Great Basin of Nevada are next in line for the heavy rainfall. Then it's the Columbia River Basin up towards parts of Idaho and even eastern Oregon as well. One thing that I think is important, though, is a lot of folks didn't really know what they'd be facing. When you grow up in the desert, when you live here for 30, 40, 50 years, you don't see rain like this all that often. And I think a lot of folks oftentimes make the mistake of basing their actions, what they will do, on past experience. The difficulty when you have an event that is sort of unprecedented or extremely rare like this is that people don't really have a basis of comparison. They can't really draw on prior experience because what they will experience is unlike anything that they have before. And so in this case, I think some folks were prepared, but I was really disappointed to see how many people were out driving, looking around, gawking at what was going on because the conditions were dangerous.
Matthew Cappucci talking to the BBC from Palm Springs. Communities around the world are increasingly looking for solutions to the problem of food shortages due to rapid climate change. In Tanzania, this includes adopting new methods of sustainable agriculture. The BBC's Egan Salla heard about one young farmer in the Arusha region using what's known as a grey water system to utilise wastewater.
Harvest all year round, summer to spring. It is this sewage collection system that changed the history of this young farmer.
We have no alternative when the summer season arrives, so always during the summer season, you have to find that we stop the production of these vegetables and spices.
Putting this idea into action took time and cost him money, but today he's happy with its result. Inside this well is a mixture of large and small stones, all of which are placed in special order so as to filter every drop of wastewater that enters here and ensure that it is used again for agriculture and breeding activities in this farm. There's more than grey water system that keeps the farm green.
As you can see, this is our toilet too, but at the moment, it is completely full. We close it, we leave it for 6 months, all the excrement grows, rots and grows like soil. But there are also special insects that we breed here to digest, and then they turn all the dirt into fertilizer. We send it to the farm, and so on, until the second hole comes to fill this while it is already growing, because it takes time.
Since he installed the system in his farm, his yield has increased from harvesting twice a year, and now he harvests twice as much as he used to harvest before. From time to time, fellow farmers from the neighborhood and even far away have been flooding his farm to learn, and some have already put this knowledge into practice.
When we are told about irrigation, we believe that you must buy a big pump, go to the river, draw the water, and irrigate your farm. No, there are many systems.
If you have a farm and the area where people live on that farm, you can use the water they use to return it to agriculture. It grows better.
Tanzania's Deputy Minister of Agriculture, Anton Mavunde, earlier this year said that the Tanzanian government intends to increase sales of produce to $2 billion per year by 2023.
That report from the Arusha region of Tanzania by Egan Salla. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Danny Cox and produced by Harry Bly. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.